Well, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Minnesota House of Representatives Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee for this Thursday, January 28th, 2021. My name is Frank Hornstein. I'm the chair of the committee, and I'd like to welcome everybody again today. Our first item of business is to call the roll of committee members. And so once your name is announced by the committee legislative assistant, Mr. Dodge, just simply say present, and then we'll move on from there. Mr. Dodge.
Chair Hornstein.
Present.
Vice Chair Cagle.
Present.
Representative Petersburg.
Present.
Representative Barr.
Present.
Representative Bernardi.
Present.
Representative Elkins.
Present.
Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Hausman.
Present.
Representative Heinrich. Representative Heinrich. Representative Kosnick.
Kosnick, present.
Representative Mason. Representative Mason. Representative Murphy. Representative Murphy. Representative Nelson.
Present.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Richardson. Representative Richardson. Representative Torkelson.
Present.
Representative West.
Present.
There is a quorum.
Heinrich present.
Representative Heinrich is present, Mr. Dodge.
Noted.
Okay, members, well, thank you. Our first item of business is approval of the minutes for our January 26th meeting. Representative Petersburg, is there a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to move the approval of the January 6th minutes of this committee.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. To the motion to approve the minutes, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, the motion carries. Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Members, today we're going to kind of continue our conversation about the state of our infrastructure, transportation infrastructure in the state. We are going to hear from primarily local counties and cities. We're going to start with an overview, though, of the state of our infrastructure from MnDOT. And then, you know, our task is really to put together a finance bill for this year. And we're going to do a piece today that, while it's not a formal bill, we are going to hear a fairly specific proposal from small cities around funding. You know, I know that Representative Torkelson is very familiar with this. People who've served on the committee for a long time know that it's been kind of a vexing issue over the years, how to fund the needs of small cities, and then also townships I would include in this category. So there is a proposal. Again, it's not a bill, but we're going to hear at least some very general parameters of that today. And then shortly after 2 o'clock, we'll hear our first bill, Representative Dabney's House File 103. So that's the plan for today. And our first speaker is the Program Director for Statewide Planning at MnDOT, Mr. Philip Schaffner. And Mr. Schaffner will speak in about, you know, 5 to 8 minutes, Mr. Schaffner, just to give us a sense of, you know, where are we at with the state of our road and bridge infrastructure in Minnesota right now, and what do we need to do to upgrade it? Mr. Schaffner, please state your name for the committee for our official record, and then you can proceed.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein. Members of the committee, my name is Philip Schaffner. I am the Director of Statewide Planning at the Minnesota Department of Transportation. I'm joined today by our Manager of Legislative Affairs, John Dukic. Thank you for the opportunity to give you a brief update on the current and future condition of our state trunk highway system. This is 100-year-old system, is represents about 10% of the public roads in the state of Minnesota, just under 12,000 centerline miles of road, more than 4,500 bridges. It carries more than half of all vehicle miles traveled in the state. Pre-pandemic levels were at about 35 billion vehicle miles per year. Of course, the system is more than just highways and bridges. It includes a variety of other roadside infrastructure, more than 600 miles of sidewalks. It has thousands of culverts, guardrails, retaining walls, signals and signs, and many other assets. It has more than 22,000 intersections and 800 interchanges as part of the system. Today, I'm only going to talk about two of our major assets, our pavements and our bridges. And one of the notes of distinction here, you will see a distinction between our interstates, our non-interstate national highway system routes, and our other state highways. A little less than half of our state highways are principal arterials and therefore part of the national highway system in this country, which constitutes all principal arterials in the country. These tend to be our higher volume roads and serve longer distance and regional trips and are underpinning of our commerce and our state. To begin with, looking at our bridges, we evaluate our bridges through inspections and use the National Bridge Inventory rating system that rates our bridges on a good, fair, and poor rating system. We have targets for both good and poor. The good targets had been set a while ago based on longstanding condition. And over the last 4 to 5 years, we have improved the accuracy of our rating system, both through improved training, quality control, and quality insurance, being much more strict about when we rate a bridge in good condition. And as such, although our bridges themselves haven't changed their condition, our understanding of how many are in good condition has changed. And we are reevaluating whether those targets are appropriate still for our good condition bridges as part of an update to the 20-year state highway investment plan that we are undertaking this year and going into next year. Of particular concern for us is bridges in poor condition. And we have fairly strict targets about the percentages of our bridges that are in those conditions. These percentages are based on the percent of the deck area of our bridges. So larger bridges will weight higher into the rating of this here. It's not the number of bridges. And while sort of the good news is that within our current 4-year State Transportation Improvement Program, or STIP, we by the end of our current program, we will be meeting and being within our targets for bridges in poor condition. However, when we look beyond the 4 years into our 10-year capital highway investment plan, we are concerned about the state that we will be in at the end of that plan without additional funding. Right now, a big piece of the story is the largest bridge in our state, the Blatnik Bridge, carrying I-535 between Duluth and Superior, Wisconsin. It's about a 1.5-mile long bridge that is coming due for major replacement or reconstruction. We are currently still evaluating our options for this bridge, and it will be a point of discussion that we will be sharing with you in future meetings and future years. Currently, we're scheduling work sometime in the 2028 through 2030 time horizon. And although we have currently set aside several years of bridge funding on the national highway system for that bridge, we anticipate that the cost of replacing part or all of that bridge could be hundreds of millions of dollars higher than what we have available. And it's clear that funding that replacement of that bridge is likely beyond our capacity to handle through our normal construction program. and will be a point of question and concern for us as we head into the later half of this decade. But the Blatnik Bridge is just one part of a number of bridges of a similar era that are coming due for major repairs and replacement. And so we do anticipate growing bridge needs when we look out towards the next 10 years and beyond, as we have something of a bubble of bridges coming due for additional work. Right now, there are more than 800 bridges that our bridge replacement and improvement management system indicates should have some type of repair or replacement by 2030 that we do not have in our 10-year current plan. And we'll not be able to get to unless we get an increase in funding over that same time horizon. So again, within the next 4 years, we should be and anticipate be within our targets, but we will not be by the end of the 10 years. Shifting to pavements here, apologize for having lots of numbers on one screen. We have different targets for our interstates, for our national highway system pavements, and for our other state highway pavements, for both good and poor condition. The good news is that our current condition is within all of our targets for all three of those systems. And as we look out towards the end of our four-year state transportation improvement program, we start to hit slightly above our targets for percent poor, but we'll be meeting all of our targets for percent good. And when we look out through the full 10 years of the program, our interstates will continue to be in good shape, meeting or within or exceeding targets. We do, however, start to have concerns as we head to the end of our 10-year highway investment plan. And we, absent additional funding, we will be in unprecedented territory for the mileage of our highways in poor condition. Since the turn of the century, since 2000, our national highway system pavements have never been above 5% poor, and we are forecasting that they will be at 6% poor at the end of the plan. And our non-national highway system or other state highway pavements have never been more than 9% poor since 2000, and we are showing that they will be exceeding our target of 10% or less poor by the end of the CHIP, the Capital Highway Investment Plan. Poor pavements, good and poor. This is a measurement of the ride quality of the road, essentially a measurement of the smoothness of the road driving at 50 miles per hour or greater. It is only one of several different measures that we have, but it's a very important measure for us. Pavements that are in poor condition are too bad to drive on at highway speeds. They increase wear and tear on vehicles and can damage manufactured goods, or harm or kill livestock that are being transported over roads in poor condition at highway speeds. So they are of particular concern for us as we look out into this territory and into the second 10 or towards the 10 years of our highway investment plan. Without additional funding, we are forecasting that the number of miles in poor condition will more than double, from a little over 500 miles in 2019 to over 1,000 miles in 2030. Most of these are lower volume roads, but nevertheless are a real concern for us as a state and the quality of life and the economy that we are trying to support through our transportation infrastructure. We do also look at many other indicators in terms of the life of our assets. We do look and pay attention to life cycle cost, aim to make the right fix at the right time to the extent that we are able through our construction program. One of the indicators of that is remaining service life, which is a measure in years until our pavement reaches a ride quality index of 2.5, which is a fair condition road. But it is at the point where most people would find it uncomfortable to drive at, and generally speaking, a major rehabilitation is likely needed. As you can see, we have and continue to invest in longer life fixes on our interstate, to a lesser extent on our national highway system routes, and to an even lesser extent on our other state highways. Again, longer life here is generally beneficial. It means we are touching that pavement on average less frequently and needing to interrupt traffic for repairs less frequently.
Mr. Schaffner, this is really really important key stuff, and I just appreciate your presentation so much. I don't know if you wanted to just conclude with how to contact you, but I did want to get to any member questions we have.
Thank you, Chair Ornstein. Yes, that was my concluding remarks there. We do have a lot of information about other parts of our system, other types of performance, other types of needs at performance.minnesotago.org, where you can also find some of our statewide transportation plans. I appreciate the opportunity, and I'm stand for questions.
Members, I don't see questions yet, but I will start with one. And if, again, I want to reiterate my thanks. I think this is absolutely critical information that you've shared with us. I did have a question on the, you know, on the bridge slide, and I'm going to go by memory here, but you know, you had certain percentages for you know, poor and good, but then there was a lot of sort of, you know, percentages in between. It didn't add up to 100. So are we just assuming the rest are in fair condition, or I just wanted to get a sense. It was a little unclear to me on that slide, sort of where the rest of the roads sort of fit in, if they weren't considered good or poor.
Chair Hornstein, yes, you're correct. The remaining percentages are in fair. So that's, they break down into good, fair, and poor. And the numbers add up if you add in the fair. We don't have targets for fair, just for good and poor.
Okay, so those, thank you very much, Mr. Schaffner. So that's that clarifies then that for us. And again, there's the MnDOT has some very clear criteria for how those roads are classified. So, and I imagine if we go to performance.org, that will all be explained. Correct, Mr. Schaffner?
Correct, Chair Hornstein.
Okay, well, now we've got some questions. All right, I'm going to take three because we're going to have to move on relatively quickly, and I'll do them in this order. Representative Petersburg, Representative Cagle, and Representative Bernardi. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is actually just a transportation 101 for some of the newer members, but Mr. Schaffner, you mentioned that we have a little under 12,000 miles in our trunk highway system. Constitutionally or statutorily, we have a cap, which most people don't realize, as to the number that we can actually have in that system. Do you know what that cap is?
Do not know the exact number, Representative Petersburg, but it is approximately, it is around the 12,000 mile number. And we can get the exact number for you after this meeting.
Thank you, and Mr. Chair?
Yes, the Representative Petersburg.
And that's kind of what I think it's important for people to know is that when we get close to that range or above, we have to start giving some roads back as well because we can't go beyond that cap. And it's just some informational piece, part of things that I found interesting when I first came on the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. And Representative Petersburg, your question sort of just is also a reminder for folks who may be new or need a refresher or a reminder. Mr. Schaffner was really just simply talking about the state system. And, you know, we're going to hear a little bit later today, you know, there is a county system, there is a city system, there is a township system, you know, they all, and of course the federal system. And so they all, which was included in Mr. Schaffner's comments, but all of these kind of work together. And just to emphasize this, Mr. Schaffner was talking exclusively about the state system. Representative Cagle, our vice chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is, so one of the big issues up in our area is Highway 65. And so from my understanding, what you're saying is right now MnDOT doesn't have even enough funding to maintain the current road system. And so we have a project analysis going on of Highway 65 of how we can improve that and make the traffic flow better. But from what you're saying, that's not going to happen unless we get more funding, correct?
Mr. Schaffner.
Chair and member, we do have different funding streams that have specific objectives and goals. So we spend about 2/3 of our funding on maintaining the existing infrastructure, pavement, bridge, and other roadside infrastructure. But we do have other programs that are aimed at addressing other types of needs, such as mobility, congestion, safety. improving ADA and other needs. My understanding of the Highway 65 corridor and the needs, it's unlikely that we would be able to address all or a majority of those needs without additional funding. That is correct.
Thank you. And then we do say we want to move on quickly. So we have one more question from Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here, Mr. Schaffner. I do have a question regarding the bill we passed. We've had bipartisan support on some performance measure work that I've been working on, and we've been collectively working on it together. I wanted to find out what's the status on the part that passed about making sure that we have an inventory for all our different types of transportation assets like geotechnical, bike, ped, road, bridges. Could you just tell me what some of the new, where you're at on getting that inventory up to par? And can you just give us an example of new geotechnical that you're doing? And I just want to say, I noticed you said you had 600 miles of sidewalks, and I noticed that, and thank you for doing an inventory on those. I appreciate that.
Mr. Schaffner.
Chair and member, thank you for the question. And we are, in fact, updating our inventory of our sidewalks right now. That is an effort that is underway. In terms of the geotechnical assets, we have developed an approach for how to create that inventory and are commencing that work right now. We've actually just identified a lead staff person to undertake that effort. So we have identified a methodology for conducting that inventory and are starting that process right now. And we can provide you an update after this with more specific details if you'd like.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schaffner. And thank you, Representative Bernardi, for, you know, I think as long as you've been on this committee, you have been really active in pressing on these performance measures. And I know that's going to continue. So thank you very much for raising that. Members, and thank you, Mr. Schaffner, the really very, very helpful information, and it's much appreciated. We're going to shift members to our second panel for the day, and we're going to go into, I mentioned that there's a county and city system, and we're going to talk about that now. We have a county and a city engineer who have joined us, and our first speaker is going to be Dave Kramer, the Winona County engineer. And many of you went to Winona to the model or the mini session. I'm getting Representative Pulaski's projects mixed up. He has a model legislature, but he also has a mini session. And we went to the mini session in October of 2019. And we had a very active day there in the Transportation Committee. We visited the Amtrak station. We looked at some bridge infrastructure from underneath on the river, and we had a hearing, but then we also took a field trip out into the county, and Mr. Kramer was very impressive, so I wanted him back. If you'll recall the members that were on that tour, he showed us some examples of literally crumbling county roads, and I can think of no better person to speak, you know, for all of our wonderful county engineers who he's sharing. We heard from one also from Stearns County the other day, but this is really his presentation about Winona is really reflective of the entire state and especially rural Minnesota. So I wanted to have him back and present to the entire committee and via Zoom. And Mr. Kramer, thank you so much. I've really appreciated your work and your presence in MICA over the years, and appreciate your being here. Please state your name for our committee record and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein. David Kramer, K-R-A-M-E-R, Winona County Engineer. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about county roads and bridges, and thank you, Chair Hornstein, for the kind words about the tour in 2019. Unfortunately, in a Zoom format, I've not been able to figure out a way to provide that same seat of the pants feel for the roads, but I do have a couple pictures, and I'll try to do the best that I can. Winona County has 385 miles of county roads. You just heard from MnDOT. They have about 10% of the roads in the state. Just for comparison, in Winona County, we have a little bit more than twice as many miles of road than MnDOT has in Winona County. Roughly 20% of our miles are funded with local funds only. So essentially the property tax levy has been the traditional method of funding those for the county board. And then roughly 80% of our 385 miles are on the county state aid system, which that is really the bread and butter of the county highway system, established in 1957. And as you're probably aware, 60% of those funds are for construction and 40% go towards maintenance. The 0.5% sales tax that the legislature provided for the counties to be able to enact has been a godsend for us in Winona County. My county board enacted the 0.5% sales tax in 2017. They enacted it so it started being collected in 2017. As I was presenting them information about our needs, they actually waited a couple years prior to doing that, kind of hoping the legislature would step up with some significant funding. And when that didn't happen, out of necessity, they enacted that 0.5% sales tax. It was actually some of my very most conservative board members voted in favor of it because they are hearing very consistently from their constituents, you've got to do something about these roads. So that 0.5% sales tax in Winona County generates $3.1 million per year currently. In comparison, our county state aid construction apportionment for 2021 for this year is $3.4 million. So our $3.1 million we're collecting in sales tax is only slightly smaller than our total construction revenue we get from the state for our state aid system. Prior to the county board enacting that 0.5% sales tax, we were backsliding badly. Our system was basically going downhill and there was just nothing we could do about it from a funding standpoint. So at this point, we're not catching up, but as I like to say, we're falling behind more slowly. So that funding has allowed us the sales tax to fund some essentially deferred projects on our county system because there just wasn't a good funding for that before. However, the majority of those sales tax funds are going towards our CASA system, our county state aid highway system, due to the need there and the funds not going far enough that we get through the state. I've got some pictures to show you. I can't, like I say, give you the feel for the roads, but I'm gonna share my.
Sometimes, Mr. Kramer, sometimes the picture is 1,000 words, so okay. We appreciate you doing that.
You're welcome, Chair Hornstein. So this is our County Road 114. Just as an example, this is taken in fall of 2018. You can see they're combining corn and hauling that on the road. You can see oncoming a couple trucks. So these roads get used for that purpose. This is a road that is not on our 5-year plan. I often get calls from people. You've got to do something about this road. When are you going to pave, my road? Unfortunately, I've gotten very accustomed to answering the questions about it's not even on our 5-year plan. This road, our 5-year plan goes out to 2021 through 25. We have a strong enough need that this road isn't even on that yet. Just to zoom in a little bit, the road is literally disintegrating. And this is in that same location. You go a little farther down the road. Again, you can see there's happened to be a fair amount of trucks on this road. The edge is breaking up and the road is deteriorating. So as we're, prioritizing our funds, we can only do projects based on funding that we have. And so that's just our reality. This is a different road. This is our county state aid highway 33. This project is on our 5-year plan in 2025. This project is programmed with a mix of state aid funds and our county levy funds. This road has in comparison to the previous road, you know, more transverse cracks going across the road. You can see those in the photo there. Again, it's disintegrating essentially. This road, if you drove down it, you would get that seat of the pants feel that it is a road that needs some help. Just switching gears to bridges. Thank you very much for the $30 million of bridge bond funding or local bridge replacement program funding that was approved in the bonding bill in the special session last fall. That is just absolutely critical for our local bridges. That's our bread and butter for that program is the bridge bond funding part of our program. Just this Tuesday, 2 days ago, my county board awarded a $2.3 million project to replace two bridges. Part of the funding mix for that is $950,000 of those bridge bond funds that were approved last fall. So, you know, we're putting that money to use right away. And then we have two more bridges that will be funded. Those will be bidding this summer for construction next summer. I'd like to highlight one of the bridges that we will be replacing. It's our bridge 85502. It's on our County Road 5 towards the southern part of the county. If you look at the bridge, there's really nothing that stands out from the surface. You can't tell what the condition of the bridge is. If we would have had time on our tour at the mini session, I would have very much liked to have gotten the committee and taken you down to this bridge and gotten you actually underneath this bridge, because you'd see this underneath the bridge. This is a precast pieces that were, this bridge was built in 1963. With the deterioration of this bridge, the concrete is falling and the steel is badly rusting, and that's not even the worst of it. So there's piers underneath this bridge, and the piles at the ground line, some of them are literally rusted through. So this is a bridge that we've been had in our program for replacement for several years. We've actually deferred it for several years due to the not being adequate state local bridge replacement program funding. So with that condition, this bridge, you know, as it deteriorates, we post the loads that are safe for the bridge. This one's posted 12 tons for a single unit vehicle, such as a tandem axle dump truck. Those trucks can legally, a typical legally loaded one will be 50 to 56,000 pounds. So this is, the bridge is safe for less than half of that. A legally loaded five axle semi will be 40 tons or 80,000 pounds. Again, 22 tons is quite a bit less than that. This is my highest hazard bridge as far as for the traveling public. We do know anecdotally that fully loaded trucks go across this. I've just been hoping we would be able to get it replaced before something tragic happens. We're getting close to that, where we've got it actually contracted now to be for replacement this summer. So it will be very good to get this bridge replaced. I just would like to emphasize when Minnesota County Engineers Association or Association of Minnesota Counties or Minnesota Intercounty Association is suggesting bridge bond funding, you know, an amount of 30 or 50 or 100 million. This is the type of bridge that, you know, is really needing to be replaced with those funds. The other thing I would say is our bridge program, you know, has some lead times in developing projects. Also, it's very important for the continuity for the contractors to have essentially a steady flow of work. When there's a year or two of very dry times, we lose our contracting capacity. And then when we have a big bridge program, you know, we're not able to get good bids because there's not enough contractors out there to do the work. So it's really important from a contracting and economic standpoint to have essentially a steady funding source, that we do have the local bridge replacement program funded, you know, consistently, so that we're not just creating a backlog, but we're actually just keeping the backlog low and have a kind of a constant flow of these local bridge projects, because those, it's very important for those contractors and for us to get good value for the taxpayers so that we do keep some competition out there. That's all I have, Mr. Chair, and I'll stand for questions. Chair Hornstein, you're muted.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Thank you for that. An engineer is a good person to tell me I'm muted. I appreciate it. And, you know, we're going to have a very brief opportunity for questions and answers after our next speaker, who will give us a perspective from the city level. I'd like to call on Mr. Marcus Culver, PE. He is the director of public works in Roseville, but he's also the committee chair for the City Engineers Association here in Minnesota. And we're very happy to have Mr. Culver, and welcome to the committees. Please state your name for the record. And members, we're probably going to have just a limited amount of questions here for this panel. So, you know, if you have some pressing issues, you know, maybe you could write them down and we can send them into our guests. Maybe we'll have time for one or two questions. But welcome to the committee, Mr. Culver, and we appreciate your being here.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein, and thank you very much for the opportunity to present to the committee today. As you stated, my name is Mark Culver. I'm the Public Works Director for the City of Roseville. I'm a past president and current chair of the Legislative Committee for the City Engineers Association, which is a statewide association of more than 400 municipal engineers and consultants that design, operate, and maintain the city roads, utilities, facilities, and other municipal infrastructure. There are 853 cities of varying size and landscape across the state of Minnesota. And from the slide here on the numbers, you can see that there's quite a variation in the sizes and distribution of those cities. Bottom line, Minnesota cities are diverse. Within those cities, municipal streets account for over 22,000 miles of roadways in the state, which is approximately 16% of all the roadway mileage in the state. However, city streets very often make up a good portion of that last mile of our economy, product delivery, employment centers, schools, and of course, homes. And so these roads are critical to local and statewide economies. Maintenance of this system is essential if cities are to maximize their investments in this infrastructure. According to the U.S. Department of Transportation, every $1 spent on maintenance saves us $7 in repairs or reconstruction. And of course, the best time to do this maintenance is when the pavement condition is still good. So a well-maintained streets will look like this. You know, they're not always beautiful and sparkling and everything, but they look good, they hold up. And I'd like to think, and in Roseville in particular, we take a lot of pride in how we maintain our streets. And we do spend a lot of time and invest a lot of money into that maintenance. However, despite our best efforts, over time, our streets deteriorate and need to be replaced or reconstructed at a significant cost. And delayed maintenance accelerates this. Delayed reconstruction requires even more extensive reconstruction and is much more expensive. And just to put that in perspective, it's kind of like not replacing a leaking dishwasher in your kitchen, but you're still using it. Eventually, not only will you need to replace the dishwasher, but you're going to need to replace the floor underneath that dishwasher, the subfloor underneath that, the ceiling underneath that, and on the longer you wait to actually replace that dishwasher. And it's the same thing for our roads. The longer we wait to reconstruct our roadways, the deeper we have to go, the more we have to invest in bringing that roadway up to the standard that we need. So what is the state of our roadways? And just generally speaking, it's a lot of cities use their own methods of inventorying the condition of their roadways. And so we don't have a really solid condition or condition rating like MnDOT has for their roads for all of the cities across the state. But the ASCE report card from 2018, and of course these are all the roadways, county, state, and local, gives our roadways a grade of D plus across the state and a grade of C for our bridges. And we just heard from the county engineer some really good information about the state of our bridges. So how do we fund street maintenance and construction at the local level? Our one dedicated funding source for that is municipal state aid funding, which hopefully all of you know is our distribution of the state gas tax. We also rely on programs that this body has been very supportive over the years, such as the local road improvement program and the local bridge replacement program funded generally through bonding bills. There are federal funds available to cities as well, but all of those funds besides the MSA are competitive funding programs with generally many, many more applications than available funds. So we turn to other local sources such as property taxes, special assessments, and private development were allowed by state law. And the local funding sources have their challenges. As with all budgets, especially now as we face deficits at all levels, city budgets are strained. Special assessments are unpopular politically and are difficult to administer given the limitations of state law. Additionally, tax-exempt properties don't pay property taxes. So if we're using property taxes as our primary source of local street funding, you have some large users of that infrastructure that don't pay anything. So while good proactive maintenance is affordable, it isn't, and in many cases, it can't be a priority in our city budgets. The biggest frustration is that we have no dedicated funding source for our local non-MSA streets like we do for our public utilities, like we do with water, sanitary sewer, and even stormwater. Funding sources that even the tax-exempt properties contribute to. Hopefully you are familiar with this, the breakdown of the Minnesota State Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. We have four primary funding sources for this fund, including the gas tax, license fees, motor vehicle sales tax, and auto parts tax. Municipal state aid gets 9% of those funds as it filters through the state and the counties. We then split that up across 148 state aid cities. It's a reliable source of funding that we are very appreciative of and we are very supportive. But as good as that source of funding is, there are many shortcomings. For starters, only cities with populations over 5,000 are eligible for these funds. So most cities in the state are actually ineligible for the MSA funds. Another significant shortcoming of this fund is that most cities use these funds as their source for required local cost participation in state and county projects. Here in Roseville, for an example, when Ramsey County constructed County Road C 2 years ago, the city of Roseville had almost $1 million in local cost participation between right-of-way costs, roadway, and storm sewer costs and trail costs. These are elements that, of course, we're very supportive of, but rather than use property taxes for those costs, those local cost participation, we use our MSA funds. So that then dilutes how much of those funds we have for our own MSA streets. Finally, we all love growth, but as cities are successful and do grow, more cities are added to the MSA system. More miles of roadway are funded. Less money per city and per mile of roadway is available to all cities. In 1958, when the state aid system was created, there were 58 MSA cities. There are now 148 MSA cities sharing that same 9% of the gas tax funds. This graph shows the loss of buying power of the current MSA fund. This is not adjusted for inflation. So we're actually, if you look between 1958 at the beginning of the graph and today at 2021, we're actually getting less money per need dollar in 2021 than we were getting in 1958. As our needs grow, primarily because of simply the growing cost of maintaining and constructing our roadways, the funding sources aren't growing at the same pace, or at any pace for that matter. So let's take a quick look at need versus funding for the city of Roseville. Roseville is a modest-sized city with a population of about 35,000. We have 119 miles of local and state aid roads. If we estimate a roadway life cycle of about 35 years, then Roseville has about $300 million in construction and maintenance needs over that 35 years. Our current MSA revenue is about $1.5 million annually. And assuming modest growth within that MSA fund, we estimate that our MSA revenue over those 35 years to be about $87 million. Of that, we expect to spend $21 million of those MSA funds on state and county roadways, which then results in a funding gap of $234 million that we need to procure from other sources. In actual practice, we should be spending about $8 to $9 million per year on our local roadways, and we're only spending about $2 to $4 million right now. That's one community, one city, looking statewide. It's a much larger gap with local MSA fund streets having an annual funding gap for non-MSA streets, annual funding gap of about $250 to $400 million. And while that study, that's from the 2012 Minnesota Transportation Finance Advisory Committee, while that was done 9 years ago, the funding gap isn't getting any smaller. It's getting bigger. So how do we address this? We know we are competing with so many other needs that you are facing, but we will continue to advocate for dedicated, reliable sources of funding for all of our streets, for maintenance as well as major construction. This means more state aid funds. We also support the Street Improvement District Authority, which would allow us to fund streets like a public utility that they are. We need funding for cities of all sizes. And of course, while these funds aren't reliable, we fully support the opportunities that have been afforded to us to fund larger regional projects through the use of bonding programs like Corridors of Commerce, Local Road Improvement Program, and others.
Mr. Culver, I don't know if you can.
Right now. Yep. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Chair Hornstein, for the opportunity to talk with us. Thank you for your continued support of our communities and giving us the tools to build high-quality multimodal roadways across the state. Thank you.
Love those pictures. Thank you. That was so helpful, Mr. Culver. And, you know, we did appreciate your breakdown of the funding sources. And, you know, we are going to have members. We are going to have opportunities for you to meet with nonpartisan staff to get more depth into that. We are just a few minutes behind. I have two mayors coming up, and I don't want to cut them off or have them wait much longer. So we have four questions. I'm going to take two. And then the other two that I don't call on, if you could just send in your questions, we can potentially get those answered with our guests. But I'm going to call on Representative Torkelson and Representative Bernardi, and then we have to move on.
Oh, thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Hornstein. Is Mr. Kramer still on?
Mr. Yes, Kramer. Representative.
Mr. Kramer?
Yes, Chair Hornstein, I'm still on.
You can proceed, Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Chair Hornstein. Thank you, Mr. Kramer, for your presentation today. Could you talk a little bit about the cost of these rural bridges, one similar to the one that you showed us in your pictures? What's it going to take to rebuild that?
Mr. Kramer.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein, Representative Torkelson. I don't have the numbers directly in front of me. I do know that for the two bridges that we awarded, the total is $2.3 million. I believe the bridge that I'm showing you the picture of is in the ballpark of a $1 million or maybe slightly below that for the replacement of that. The other bridge in that contract is slightly larger, so that's probably closer to a $1.3 million. So it's very expensive infrastructure to replace bridges.
Thank you, Mr. Kramer. Mr. Chairman Hornstein, if I could have a follow-up.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, just for the moment, let's kind of assume that $1 million price tag is more or less average for a county bridge. Of that $1 million, how much of that will come out of the local bridge fund?
Mr. Kramer.
Chair Hornstein, Representative Torkelson. Out of the bridge fund, for our bridges that are on our county state aid highway system, which this one is, we identify what we call participating costs or the actual bridge replacement itself. Out of the local bridge replacement program funds, it's half of the bridge cost. And then, so then the county generally, like for this program project through our state aid funds, would pay for the other half of the bridge plus the engineering costs plus the approach costs and the demolition of the previous bridge. So, I would say, you know, in ballpark, the local bridge replacement program would be probably one third to one half of the total cost.
Thank you, Mr. Kramer. Chair Hornstein.
Last question, Representative Torkelson. I'm going to extend this time period a few minutes for the other members, but we do need to keep going. Representative Torkelson.
Very briefly, I don't have another question, Chair Hornstein. I just am trying to point out how far local bridge money goes when we're rebuilding county bridges. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Torkelson. You know what, members, this is an important conversation. So I'm going to, all the members that I called earlier, I'm going to allow you to do your questions, but we're going to have brief questions and brief answers. I'm going to go with Bernardi, Representative Bernardi, Representative Koznick, and Representative Mason. Representative Bernardi, quickly.
Okay, well, first of all, I want to thank our presenters today and for all the people working on our transportation system. And I'll just make a quick, I'll try to make a quick comment here instead of asking a question so we don't have to have the response after and take up time. but it just seems like it's bleak for our state, and we have a huge coming infrastructure, and we ought to be asking our question, why are we looking to expand our infrastructure when we need to maintain what we currently have? And it seems like, and I was going to ask this question, but I'll just make the statement, it seems like a fix it first policy, and making policies change right now is important because we need safety, accessibility, and we need to be maintaining our crumbling infrastructure. And if we just sit and wait for money for the future, we're going to miss the opportunity to do things now to maintain our current infrastructure. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Bernardi. Good points. Representative Kosnick, and then Representative Mason, and then we're going to move on to our township and small cities presentation. Representative Kosnick.
Well, I just wanted to compliment you, Mr. Chair, for having this discussion. It is important and really is to the crux of what the committee has been challenged to do. And you've been on the committee as probably longer than anybody or as long, maybe Representative Hollins would be. So we know that it's a long and ongoing discussion about funding and has been a challenge. And you know, I think I would challenge as legislators on this committee and kind of across the state legislature to not take the funding approach as partisan as we have in the past, and myself a little bit included in that. But I have a bill to go with this conversation to, you know, maybe we should have a report on transportation funding and the formulas and then the geographic disbursements of that and how per capita, so that we can make maybe more appropriate and efficient uses of the funding dollars we have or may have in the future based on that, so that it's not this regional thing where people think that the metro is getting all our transportation dollars, when in fact in 2017 there was a report or an article in the Star Tribune where outstate Minnesota, greater Minnesota, was getting 22% more transportation dollars than the metro. And so I think if we have a report, we could more accurately identify where our needs are and how to maybe more accurately meet the needs that our testifiers have spoke to today. Thank you for the time.
Representative Kosnick, that's a great idea. I'm looking forward to discussing that with you. It's needed. So, I appreciate that. Representative Mason, just real quick, because we got to move on, and you'll be our last member question or comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This was regarding a comment Mr. Kramer made where the money was 60% for construction, 40% for maintenance. And going back to the speaker we had the other day, where it makes more sense to have a bigger percentage for maintenance. So just maybe a comment on that.
Maybe very quickly, if Mr. Kramer, Mr. Culver wants to talk on that, and then we'll move on to our next panel. But very quick, I'll call on Mr. Kramer.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein, Representative Mason. The apportionment that goes to Winona County under our state aid system is split 60% construction, 40% maintenance. For that 40% maintenance, we get it in two different installments. We get some at the beginning of the year, and then we have to submit a fund that shows our actual expenses prior to receiving the last of that. So in my experience, and I've been with the county engineer for 15 years now, that split is appropriate. It for the most part covers our maintenance funds, and we're able to, you know, utilize all of those for our maintenance. We do have a construction need that exceeds what we can cover with that 60%, but just for the ongoing maintenance, I would not recommend, based on my experience, shifting that. I think that's actually a good balance.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And, a question from a former city councilor. Little known fact, Representative Mason was on the Eagan City Council for a lot of years, so she knows from what she speaks. Mr. Kramer, Mr. Culver, thank you so much. This, as I think Representative Kosnick had mentioned, is really part of what we need to do here. And it, you set up a very good transition, especially Mr. Culver, for the next piece that we're going to work on here for another 15 minutes or so, and then we'll get to Representative Davenport's bill. But we want to work on this question of cities, the funding for small cities. And so we're going to have a couple of mayors first, and then we are going to, then move on to a discussion and then the bill hearing for Representative Dabney. So I would like to introduce first Mr. Steve Fenske. He's the general counsel of the Minnesota Association of Townships. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Fenske. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Steve Fenske with the Minnesota Association of Townships. Are you guys able to hear me okay? Yes.
I can hear you just fine.
Thank you. Thanks for the chance to address the committee. Townships, our organization represents 1,780 townships, and they manage about 55,000 miles of road. And it's actually more, because we only count what's open a full year. There are a lot of roads that are open partial times of the year, and we don't count those. These are often gravel roads. They're the first mile, often in agriculture, mining, and logging. And they're a critical piece of the infrastructure that those industries use. Townships also maintain about 6,000 bridges. And at any one time, about 400 of them are on the critical list. They need replacement, and that's an important piece of what they do. And we work closely with counties on that bridge maintenance. Townships infrastructure is primarily transportation. 65% of their revenues go right to roads. And this is reflected in the state auditor's report from last year. 65% of the revenue, it's about $230 million. So when they do get that money, it's usually going into that or the fire contract. That's the typical thing that township does with it. They do have more need, as do other local governments, but this has been known for quite some time. And what we're asking the committee for is a 20 million per year increase in what towns receive, and that's just to maintain what they have. There are some other programs you'll hear about, local road improvement program, and some others that may be used to improve those roads, and that's an important piece too. Farming equipment in particular has only gotten larger. You're going to hear truck weight bills this year. These roads simply were not built for it. And so the answer from our members either needs to be that we can't keep increasing that weight, or we have to build these roads so that they can accommodate that weight. I know you're in a hurry, so Mr. Chair, I'll leave it there, and thank you again for letting me speak to the committee today.
Thank you so much, Mr. Fenske, and you know, hopefully we'll have a little bit of time for questions, and if there's a point or two that you couldn't make and want to make, we'll give you that opportunity. But I am really excited because we've got two mayors joining us now, and you know, again, we're going to get in a little bit more depth into some of the needs of small cities here. The first guest is Mayor Tim Burkhart from the city of Hinckley, and then following him we'll have Mayor Mary McComber from the city of Oak Park Heights. So, Mr. Burkhart, the Honorable Mayor, Mr. Burkhart, welcome to the committee. Thank you for your time. Please state your name for the record, and we'll proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Hordenstein, and for the record, my name is Tim Burkhart. I'm Deputy Mayor, City of Hinckley. I'm also a City Council member. So I've gotten an elevation.
I promoted you.
That, you did. The pay didn't go up.
The Deputy Mayor does a lot of work, though.
More than you think. I've been a council member since 2008. I'm also currently serving as the president of Minnesota Association of Small Cities. And for the record, small cities for our organization are cities under 5,000 population in Minnesota, which is slightly over 700 cities statewide. Our population in Hinckley is just over 2,000 at the last census, and we are poised for some new growth, both in population and business, but we do need some of our concerns addressed. That's why we're meeting here today. So you know, in Hinckley, traffic comes off of I-35 for year-round recreational activities like camping and snowmobiling at St. Croix State Park, maybe biking on the Munger Trail, or maybe a round of golf at Grand National Golf Course, maybe even a caramel roll at Toby's, or even a stop at Grand Casino. With all this activity and more, our city streets get more than their fair share of wear and tear as the halfway stop between Minneapolis and Duluth, as well as being the gateway to northern Wisconsin via Highway 48, a lot of traffic. I think the last road count showed over 1.5 million vehicles per year take the Hinckley exit, so there is traffic. Historically, we have filled a lot of potholes and performed some patching and crack sealing in a number of problem areas with the dollars generated by the streets assistance dollars in the years we've received funding. We also repaired some sewer access points damaged by increasing traffic flow. Of course, the full maintenance cost is much more than that. Keep in mind, we received some small cities assistance in 2016, nothing the next year, and then smaller amounts for 2 years. And we're back again, hoping for a little bit of a change of the landscape. As you know, the account has no standing appropriation in the state budget. We know the governor's committed to increasing dollars for roads and other transportation modes, and we're still zeroed out in the budget, I believe, he proposed this week. So the story is pretty much the same for all of our small communities in East Central Minnesota. I visited with a number of them lately. All of the 700 plus small cities in Minnesota don't get dedicated direct state aid highway, as you've heard earlier from some of the people that really know the system. Many of these cities are struggling economically as a result. So on behalf of the communities across Minnesota, we're asking you to please make an effort to look at the whole system, including the streets in small cities that rely entirely on property taxes and assessments. That way we won't fall further behind in needed road maintenance, and we know that maintenance is the key. So I thank you for your time in being able to paint a picture.
Well, thank you very much, Deputy Mayor Burkhart. That was really incredibly helpful. Again, members, this has been a vexing issue for this committee for many years, and I'm really hoping this will be the year that we can move some money into these really underfunded communities that don't have a dedicated source. Our final speaker for this panel is Mayor Mary McCumber from the City of Oak Grove Heights. Welcome to the committee, Mayor, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mary McCumber. I'm the mayor of Oak Park Heights, and I'm also the past president and current board member with Minnesota Association of Small Cities. The district that I represent at Small Cities is District 8, which is basically all of the metro counties. And part of that, as you've heard earlier, is there's over 700 cities under 5,000, and many of them are in the metro area. Oak Park Heights is one of them. We're a city of about 4,600 residents, although the number grows to about 30,000 and more during any given day due to the fact that we are the host to the LNS King Plant, the Oak Park Heights Maximum Security Prison, the Stillwater Area High School, Anderson Windows offices, but Council Waste Treatment, and then we have a large commercial district along Highway 36. We're also a border city with Wisconsin on the Far East Metro of St. Paul, and our traffic has increased tremendously since the opening of the St. Croix River crossing. Like so many cities under 5,000, we do not receive municipal state aid. We are also one of the rare cities that does not receive local government aid either. So as such, all of our road maintenance and any improvements falls solely on a taxpayer's Oak Park Heights. This year, our city's maintenance budget will be approximately $409,000, primarily for pothole filling, repairing roads damaged by water main breaks, striping, and a small section of the city which will be seal coated just to protect our investment that we have on those roads. There also can be additional burdens when, for many of these small cities, when there are joint projects with either the counties or the state, which we require cost participation from our cities, and which also takes away when we have to participate in those. It takes away from anything that we could do for further maintenance on our own roads. The Small Cities Assistance Account was extremely helpful, and we're really grateful for all of your help with that. But it does need a consistent source of funding so that we can future plan for our maintenance and make sure that none of our roads fall apart anymore, which is the lack of funding obviously leads to disrepair, making them left safer vehicles, as you've heard before, for bicyclists, vehicles, and pedestrians alike when they have to dodge cars that are jumping out of potholes. We respectfully request your consideration of a dedicated funding source to small communities. These funds could be better anticipated and budgeted locally for project funding. It would be beneficial and help reduce the local tax burden on our residents when there's more equitability when compared to larger cities that do receive municipal state aid. I cut it short because a lot of things I wanted to say have been said before and I didn't want to be redundant, but I really do appreciate you speaking with us today and your consideration going forward. Thank you again, Mr. Chair and committee, and I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mayor McCumber. We appreciate your presence here a lot and your message. And we have one question from Representative Petersburg. Before I get to him, I just wanted to say that there is legislation in process to address this issue. This committee will be hearing it probably in the later part of February. That's my hope at this point, or early March, and for possible inclusion in our finance bill. So this is really something that we're very committed to. We appreciate your kicking off our discussion about this, both Mayor McCumber and Deputy Mayor Burkhart. So we have one member question, and then we're going to get to Representative Dabney's bill. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I don't have a question. I'm just directing the committee to the knowledge that in the handouts, the packet, there is a letter from a small town in my area, from Janesville as well, for them to read that reinforces what we've heard already. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oh,
thank you, Representative Petersburg, for your contribution of that letter. And members, please read it. And I'm sure that there's many other mayors that agree with all of that agree with this perspective. And so thank you so much, everybody, for your testimony today. This was very important, and we will be revisiting all of the issues that were raised today as we develop our finance bill. So members, we're now going to hear our first bill of this biennium. So history in the making here, this is going to be the first transportation bill, I believe, that Representative Olson and Representative Frederick will be hearing. So history made, Representative Dabney, in the Transportation Committee. And before I introduce, and I will move House File 103, Representative Dabney. The motion is going to be to lay this over. We're going to keep it in the committee because there are some finance questions that are still outstanding. But we wanted to hear this bill early, Representative Dabney, because I know you've worked on it over a few years. It's a very important bill. And I will say that Representative Dabney is no stranger to transportation issues. For those of you who might have experienced frustration over many years, if you're sitting at a red light and it turns green, but then there's somebody blocking the intersection because that person decided to move into that intersection from the other direction, it's called the box, blocking the box. And it was very frustrating for many commuters over many years. And Representative Dabney did something about that. So among your many accomplishments in the legislature, there's a transportation one that I think a lot of the motoring public appreciates, Representative Dabney. So welcome to the committee. And I would love to hear more about House File 103.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thanks for that opportunity to review, my transportation claim to fame. And I have to say, this morning I was the first bill heard this session in the State Government Committee. Afternoon, the first bill heard this session in transportation. I don't know what tomorrow will bring, but it's going to be hard to follow up.
Representative Dabney is a junior high school teacher, and he clearly does his homework and gets it in on time.
Wouldn't my teachers be surprised, Mr. Chair? Well, Mr. Chair, you're right. This is a bill that I've brought forward several times over the last number of years because, and I think we can both agree, some of the best work we do is when we're connected to our community and when our constituents bring us ideas for legislation on ways to improve their lives. As the committee may know, currently the Minnesota Department of Public Safety collects the private medical data on all Minnesota drivers with diabetes who take insulin. It then does nothing with that data. This data is collected at a minimum of every 4 years, filed away, and not looked at again. House File 103 proposes a narrow repeal of the rule related to insulin-using diabetic drivers, leaving the broader administrative rule governing loss of consciousness or loss of control while driving in place. In short, House File 103 proposes DPS oversight of drivers be based on the driver's behavior, not their medical history. The sonar for this rule was last updated in 1991, 30 years ago. As my testifiers can speak more authentically to, much has changed in the care and management of insulin-using diabetes in that time. Our laws and rules, I believe, should reflect those changes, and intrusion into the private lives of Minnesotans should be limited to times of concrete evidence of actual risk when driving. With that opening, Mr. Chair, I'd ask that we move to testifiers. Mr. Leo Christensen is my constituent who first brought this idea forward to me.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. And Mr. Christensen, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Leo Christensen, and I appreciate the opportunity to present to the committee today.
You can proceed, Mr. Christensen.
Yes, as Representative Dabney pointed out, the original requirement for this was put in place in the late 60s when the best insulin was produced inside pigs, and you had to use litmus paper to tell if your blood sugar was so elevated for so long, you actually had an acidic response called ketoacidosis. The good news for people like me, I'm an insulin-taking diabetic, is that insulin and blood glucose meters have improved immensely. So, for example, I test my blood sugar 4 times a day to see where it's at. I have insulin that doesn't even need to be refrigerated, actually is in the form of a pen. I don't know if people can see that. And it also has a much more reliable response, so that when I take that insulin, because it's now based on human DNA, it actually has a very reliable response to what I eat and where my blood sugar is at. So I don't get a bunch of high highs and low lows, but I get a very consistent response, much like somebody who didn't have diabetes. One of the other things I'd like to point out is that there are no state or national statistics to show that insulin-taking diabetics get in accidents at a higher rate than the general driving public. And so if it's sort of like a guilty till proven innocent kind of situation right now. In addition, a variety of states, in the last 10 years, about 12 states have eliminated these restrictions. And it looks as if nationally, most states, if not all, will eventually repeal them due to the modern advances in how diabetics like me take care of their diabetes, which is really good news. Repealing this requirement in a very narrow way, as Representative Dabney emphasized, would reduce the paperwork for doctors. Many doctors struggle in the current paperwork requirements requirements in. I've often had to dog doctors to please sign that and send it in, or the state is going to suspend my license. They mean well, but as you know, the paperwork requirement for doctors are quite high. Reduce the paperwork requirements for the Department of Public Safety. Again, collecting data that has no value, that it's not being used, is really not a good use of state tax money. I think there's other things that the department could do with those related to public safety and transportation safety. And I just think it's an easy way to improve the lives of people like me, but it's also, I think, part of that overall process the state has been going through to look at old laws and how they and kind of cleaning them up because they no longer are as relevant to the modern world. So I think it also goes along well with that. I appreciate the chance to make my comments.
Thank you so much for testifying, Mr. Christensen. Are there any questions of the committee for Mr. Christensen? Let's see. I see Mr. West. Representative West has a question. You can proceed, Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not so much a question as in my good friend since kindergarten had his license suspended because of a paperwork mishap for this specific purpose. So actually, I've seen this firsthand, and he was quite annoyed because, it, you know, he had all the exact same things you're saying. So I can tell the committee your testimony is 100% accurate for the real situation.
Thank you, Representative West, for that comment. I'll move to Representative Heinrich and Representative Bernardi. We also have a couple more testifiers from the public that we really want to hear from them before we adjourn at 2:30. Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Christensen. I was just wondering what was the form of communication that you received to learn about these laws in the first place? Is it through the healthcare professionals, or does DPS contact you? And when somebody has that diagnosis or experiences an episode, is that something that DPS would have reached out to people on, or is that more like healthcare professionals? How do you get to know about the law there?
So it was thank you, Chair Hornstein. When I applied for my renewal of my driver's license, there's a series of questions. You see these questions yourself, and one of them is, are you an insulin-taking diabetic? Wanting to, of course, be honest and legal, I said yes. And that's when the department then turned around and said, you need to have your doctor complete this form and certify your ability to drive safely. That's how I found it. So it was really me saying, admitting on my own that I had diabetes, something I developed later in my life. And then once I was in the system, of course, I keep getting reminders.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Thank you for the question, Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I thought there was one more question for you, Mr. Christensen, but Representative Bernardi, you can go. I don't want to cut you off, Representative Bernardi.
I took my hand down, and if there's time after, I will make a comment. I'd rather hear the testifiers, but I also wanted to make a comment about
Thank you, Representative after. Bernardi. That's very considerate. We have Mr. Nathan Lowy, I believe, and following him, we'll have Mr. Travis Paulson. Mr. Lowy, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify today, and to Representative Dabney for authoring this legislation to repeal this discriminatory practice. My name is Nathan Lowy, and I've been an injectable insulin-dependent diabetic for 31 years and a licensed driver in the state for over a decade. I feel there are many angles we can view how this requirement discriminates against people with diabetes, but there isn't enough time to focus on everyone, so let me present you with two: personal experience and factual data. I have had my license suspended twice while awaiting the review process to commence by the DMV, simply because the department fell behind by more time than I was given for my doctor to fill out the form and return it to the DMV. Twice, I have been ineligible to drive due to a condition I am stricken with through no fault of my own, all while being a very well-controlled diabetic with a total of zero driving-related episodes. I am aware of numerous other diabetic drivers who have had similar experiences. Requiring diabetic drivers to repeatedly answer a question about the status of their diabetes, which is a lifelong condition, is redundant. If we consider the monetary cost to patients to simply get this form handled by their provider is often in the hundreds of dollars, which is a huge detriment to those of us who already have to pay copious amounts just to gain access to the hormone required to live. Additionally, for the diabetics who live in rural Minnesota, like myself, how are we to get to the pharmacy, the doctor, or the emergency room if we do not possess a driver's license? My pharmacy is 25 minutes from home, my endocrinologist is an hour away, and the closest emergency room is a 20-minute commute. Moving on to data, the American Diabetes Association shows just 16 states have questions specifically relating to diabetes or insulin usage, while 34 do not. 34 states view the chances of a person like myself with diabetes having an episode as the same chances as any other person with any other medical condition or impairment to have an episode. In a time when the majority of individuals are striving for equality, we have this sitting right in front of us. This is a huge opportunity to take a stand on discriminatory practices, and I thoroughly encourage all of your support on the passage of this bill. In closing, Mr. Chair, I would like to express my sincerest appreciation for the opportunity to present today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lowy, for your testimony. It's very, very helpful, and these stories really help paint a picture of how this is impacting people directly. Our next testifier is Mr. Travis Paulson. Mr. Paulson, thank you very much for your coming to our committee. Please state your name for the record. Welcome.
Hi, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Travis Paulson. I represent Northern Minnesota Advocacy Group and Paulson, Johnson & Garberg. I'm here today to talk about the actual former president of the Local 66, Dennis Fraser, his wife. It's the AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. So as you can see, a lot of people on the Transportation Department relied on him for everything from their pension to their paychecks, negotiations. And in return, when his wife was diagnosed as diabetic later in life, she was just doing the honest thing and checked on her driver's license box that, yes, I'm diabetic. And as a result of that, their insurance rates skyrocketed so high that she had to be removed from the policy and literally just could not afford to keep her on there anymore. And she lost her freedom of driving because of this. And she relies on her husband now to take her to doctor appointments and everywhere else. And I believe that might be why he retired early. I can tell you that it's not only discriminatory, but it's raising insurance rates and putting people through more financial distress, almost punishing them for a crime before one's been committed. I know there's some talk about people getting a DUI or DWI and claiming that they were diabetic, but the bottom line is in 1988 even, Mormon, Olson, Skagway, and Moreland did a study and found no correlation because a breathalyzer cannot measure ketones, and that's what's going to come up if you're diabetic. It's only going to measure alcohol in the breath if you've been drinking. So I can tell you now, just like Leo mentioned earlier, so much has changed with technology that with CGMs, continuous glucose monitors, and insulin pumps now, there is a good 20 to 30 to 40 minute lag time where it can tell you ahead of time whether you're going to be going low in the future, how much time you got before you go low. And a lot of pumps, even now, it decreases your insulin so that that won't happen. So the alarms that go off let you know there's more than enough time to find a place to pull over or treat it or take care of it if that was the case. It's just not fitting with the technology that's out there right now. I know from being a former Supreme Court fellow that this law is in conflict with state and federal laws, and it's considered discriminatory by the American Disabilities Act. I can tell you firsthand that if this needs to go to the Supreme Court, I'm willing to take it there, and it's not going to – this law won't stand up to the Supreme Court. It just won't. So basically what I'm looking for is for the Department of Transportation, which we've replaced a few board members here and there over time because of the issues with the similar law, HF 365 and SF 510 regarding diabetes and driving, for board members that weren't – in line with what everybody wanted. So whether you have a stroke or a heart attack or something happens behind the wheel, all these things can be issues. And why are they not listed? Because they're considered discriminatory. Well, why isn't diabetes? The fact is there's no research or anything done to show that diabetics are worse drivers than anyone else. And if you were at home and had a terrible low blood sugar, you had to go to the hospital to treat it, you're going to have your license suspended anyway. Just like if you had a stroke or a heart attack, they immediately suspend your license until a doctor can approve you of being capable of driving again. So you're really bound to all the same laws anyway, except for you're going to pay higher premiums and have all these things held against you, no matter how good your credit is, no matter how good your driving record is. You're going to be punished for something that you haven't done. I can tell you that we've repealed this law in pretty much every state across the nation and intend to do it here in Minnesota as well. I'm just asking that Minnesota get on board with the rest of the country and please repeal this discriminatory law.
Thank you very much, Mr. Paulson, for your testimony. I don't see his name here, but I'm going to just call it just in case we missed it for some reason. Is Mr. Peter Schuckert on the on the call here? I know he had signed up in advance. I don't see him, but members, I do want to call your attention to, so there's some written testimony as well that we've posted online. You should take a look at this as well, from Heather Mortensen, Sarah Vlasak, and the American Diabetes Association. So they've all weighed in with testimony on the record. Members, we have about 5 minutes if folks have any questions, and then I'm going to just kind of wrap up with where we're headed with this bill. And I don't know if there's anyone from DPS that wants to comment as well, but the Department of Public Safety, they're available. They didn't sign up to testify, but they have the opportunity if they would like. So are there any member questions, either for the author, Representative Davney, or for any of the folks that testified? Okay, well, I don't see any folks with their hands up. Hello?
This is John. It looks like there's a few hands up.
Oh, sorry.
Representative Petersburg and Heinrich.
Ah, I didn't see those. Thank you. That's why we have a great committee administrator to help us out here. Representative Petersburg has a question, and then Representative Heinrich has another one. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think Representative Bernardi was going to have a follow-up from earlier as well. But my question isn't necessarily about the antiquated law that looks like we have here, but rather the fact that this bill, half of the language is about expedited rulemaking, which you can maybe understand that I have a real big problem with. So I will just have to take a few minutes to just talk about expedited rulemaking, because to me, this doesn't seem like it should be a very difficult thing for us to legislate and actually put into law and statute. I'm concerned that when we abdicate our responsibility by allowing agencies to go into rulemaking, that we're not taking our job seriously. And when we're just repealing the bill, I just believe that our revisors and our staff has the ability to actually create the law that will do that without having to rely on the agency to do it through rulemaking. So I just have an aversion to that, and I just want to let people know that I'll be talking about rulemaking in the future if that's necessary. But I think we should not abdicate our responsibility and just provide the legislation ourselves. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. And Representative Heinrich, did you, and we'll go to Representative Heinrich and then Representative Bernardi, and then we'll conclude with Representative Davney with any final comments. Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to respectfully request that DPS could maybe provide our committee some statistics. It would be interesting to know how many licenses have been suspended over the, maybe in the years in the past year. How many people have reported episodes like loss of consciousness or loss of ability to operate their vehicle safely? It'd just be interesting if the DPS is keeping track of that information to see kind of where we sit there from them when they have time. Maybe they can email that to the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you. That's a really good point, Representative Heinrich. I think it's really helpful to quantify these things. And, I know that Mr. Haldalter-Fahide is on the call, and if he could provide the committee the answers to those questions or some correspondence to that effect, I think it'd be helpful. So thank you for pointing that out, Representative Heinrich. Representative Bernardi, and then we'll have the author.
Mr. Chair, for a matter of time, I'm going to not do all my remarks, but I just want to say thank you, Representative Daddy, and for the people who testified and sent their testimony in. This does impact people, not their lives, their work, and their how they get around for transportation, and it's important this gets addressed. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. We have Representative Nelson, though. I'm sure that he's got some stuff to say as the State Government Finance Chair. Representative Nelson.
There we go. I just want to say that part of what we do with expedited rulemaking is that we tell them to change the rules for laws that we passed, and that's where this falls under the expedited rulemaking piece of it. We can pass a law, but they still have to change the rule, and we're telling them to do that with the expedited rulemaking.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. It's really helpful to hear from you, because I know that your committee has weighed in on that question over the years. So again, members, a reminder that this bill is being laid over, and we will await some additional information from DPS. We will look at the fiscal note for this. I think the possible paths for it would be either inclusion in a transportation omnibus bill, or it could be sent separately to Ways and Means. But we know that there is a fiscal cost, and so we're going to keep it in the committee for now. And but, you know, we had a great hearing. Thank you, Representative Dabney, for bringing this forward. And we will keep in touch with you about, you know, where we're headed with this. And, you know, maybe it'll be necessary for you to come back. But the main thing is the hearing and getting the public testimony on the record and starting the conversation about this very, very important bill. Do you have any final thoughts that you'd like to leave us with, Representative Dabney?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And really, it's thank you to you and to the committee for hearing the bill. Thank you also to Mr. Christensen, Mr. Lowy, and Mr. Paulson for bringing the real experience and those authentic voices forward. I appreciate the deliberation. And if need be, I look forward to coming back to the committee with this bill in the future.
Well, thank you. I think that that we made a lot of headway today with this hearing, and again, we'll just work out some of the issues with the fiscal note, and then we'll hopefully be on our way here in making this important change. So with that, members, I'll just remind folks that we have our next meeting on Tuesday, and we will have a very important presentation about equity issues, particularly as they impact I-94 and the Rondo neighborhood. We'll have some of that history, some exciting work going on there, and some of the health impacts of transportation issues also on the agenda for February 2nd. And so with that, have a great weekend, everybody, and this meeting is adjourned.